And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Daniel from San Diego.
Wow, a lot of people out there. It's been a long time. Hi, I'm Daniel, and I'm an alcoholic. My birthday, sobriety date is November 17th, 1988. I've been sober by the grace of God and been coming to these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time for a long time. I would like to thank the cake takers, Joe, Maureen, Mike, and the two 90-dayers. Those little gold little chips were one of my favorite chips when I first got sober. I think I still have my original one. Congratulations on those chips. I don't know. I always want to say, you know, everybody gets here the same way, but I think I'm different. I've always thought I was different. That was probably one of my problems, you know. What it was like was that at a young age, and I don't know what age, maybe 3 to 5, somewhere in there, I knew I was different at that moment. I remember somebody in the room of the house of my parents getting yelled at or getting reprimanded or something, and their feelings were getting really hurt. Well, at least my feelings were getting hurt for them. And they didn't even know I was listening or there, and it made me cry. It made me cry, and it made me very emotionally feel real bad for that person. And they didn't even know I was in the room or the next room or nothing. And I just curled up in a corner, went back, and I just felt so bad for that person for whatever it was. I don't know if there's a brother, a sister, a cousin, or what it was. But I knew that wasn't right. There was something wrong with me. I was ashamed of it, you know, because my brothers, we were 20 years older, were tougher, and they were already contractors, and they were already out of the house, and I had older sisters that were, you know, there was 8 of us kids, but there was only usually 3 of us at a time in the house, but good Mexican family. You know, so I felt different at that point, and, you know, I hadn't even touched a drink at that age, you know. I also remember the feeling I got when I went to school for the first time in kindergarten, right here, real close. I grew up right here in San Carlos. Matter of fact, we used to come over here to Allied Gardens all the time and fight with the drunks over here. We used to have drunk fights with San Carlos against Allied Gardens, you know, and that was back in the 80s and 90s, you know. I went to Patrick Henry, didn't graduate. They wouldn't let me smoke pot in the smoking section, so I told them to screw off, you know. I said, this is a smoking section. I don't smoke cigarettes, you know. So I turned around, and at that young age when I went to school over by Pershing. Anyways, I went to elementary school over by Pershing Junior High School, and I walked in there, and all the kids were white, you know. And there wasn't a black kid, and there wasn't a Mexican kid, and there wasn't an Asian kid, and they were white. And they all had lunch boxes, and they had sandwiches wrapped in, you know, in wax paper, I think back then, and, you know, a banana, and they had, you know, in their lunch bell, you know. And me, I had a paper bag that was a second used paper bag, and I had these things that were torpedo shaped that were wrapped in aluminum foil and wax paper, and they were sort of, you know, smelt like beans and tortillas and potatoes and eggs, you know what I mean, wrapped up, you know, and they were hot and steaming. My mom got up every morning and made them, you know, and these kids had sandwiches, and I had these tacos, and I go, something's wrong here. I go, I don't belong here, you know, I don't belong here, you know, and I knew something was different, you know, and I go, you know, and then this happened every day. I mean, it didn't change, you know, my menu didn't go to, I didn't get cup of noodles, and I didn't get, you know, this and that. I got some Mexican homemade bread pudding, you know what I mean, in a little Tupperware, but it always came in a hand-me-down brown bag, you know. And then when I went to your house, I finally got invited over to your house. And I went over to your house and I sat down at the table. And when I'd sit down at the table, it's right here, San Carlos, right here. You know, I mean, we're not talking somewhere on Antarctica or, you know, New England or something. You know, we're talking right here, San Carlos, you know, 1968, you know. I was very thin-skinned also at that time. I was very thin-skinned. And I know what that is now. I didn't know what it was now, but I've always been thin-skinned. I know that, and it used to hurt, and it used to hurt like the pain I felt when I felt those people's feeling get hurt that, you know, didn't even know I was there. So when I came over to their house and I sat down at their table, and you know, we were mom served us lunch or something like that, and they pulled out forks and knives and silverware and cups and set the table, I just go, this is foreign to me. You know, I mean, we sat down and my mom bought a big thing, a basket with a blanket in it, and she stood at the stove and flopped hot steaming tortillas in it and covered it up. My dad and his kids would eat them as fast as they'd go in. And, you know, if one came down, you'd put your hand up and grab the one under the hottest one, you know what I mean, real quick, you know. And, you know, and so we didn't have that kind of stuff. We didn't eat with forks. We scooped our food up with our stuff. So right off the bat, you know, before I even hit, you know, really kindergarten or first grade, I knew I was different from where I was at. And what I did is get most alcoholics, good alcoholics do, we find a defense or a shield or some type of brick wall that we can put up to defend ourselves from being hurt. We usually put people at an arm's distance. If they hurt us verbally, we avoid them. If we hear it verbally, we sort of ignore them, even though it's hurting them, or we just go along and we smile and joke with them, but we know it's just tearing us and ripping us up apart inside. You know, their words are lashing at us, and we're smiling because we don't want to feel even less adequate, so we just go along with it, you know. And I remember doing that a lot as a young child. You know, it was very verbal. I used to get, as I got older, I'd get in a fight probably once or twice a week at the outside, at the back corner of the school on the way out the back gate, and it was because they said something about being a beaner or Mexican or something like that, and you know, that's my family, you know what I mean. So what happened was I found out that if I dressed like the white kid and if I looked like the white kid and I dated the white girl, and I got the elementary school, I won the fire marshal. At fourth grade, that was the highest you could be as a fire marshal. And I won Mary Jacobs, the most popular white gal. And I was, you know, I beat her throughout the whole election. And I got impeached within about a month. I got caught lighting matches at the back fence. And every alcoholic has a good excuse, right? I was getting rid of them from no kids would ever light nothing on fire. You know what I mean? Oh, yeah, yeah. That was right around the Nixon era. No, I was impeached about that time. It was very humbling. And I tell you, but I think the biggest thing was to beat that white girl and that, you know, but. And then she had her friend. Her best friend was Jenny Butt, and that was my friend, Jenny Butt. Oh, she was nice. She was cute. Jenny Butt, I had the biggest crush on. She had the biggest brown eyes and just the American as you could get. And, you know, and I go, if I have one of them, then I will be like them. You know, and that's what I said. If I have one of them, then I will be like one of them. So what happened was time went by, and, here it comes. I'm 12 years old now, and I still am. I don't think I've had a first drink yet. I think I think I puffed on a cigarette once and choked and gagged. And 11 or 12. And my family hunts. We do a lot of hunting since my dad came back from World War II. He settled here after World War II, and he taught us boys how to hunt and fish and stuff. You know, in the local mountains. So I wanted to get my hunting gun. I was going to be able to hunt at 12. So my brother said, well, you know, yeah, our family, you know, you work for what you do. So come to work for it. He had a construction company. And I went picking up nails and boards. And he was a big framing outfit company in San Diego. And he was, you know, and I was on the job. I'd stay at one brother's house with him in the summer. And I'd ride to work. And I'd, you know, make $1.50 an hour. Wow, you know, $1.50 an hour, and all the beer I could drink at 3:30. So that was my thing. At 3:30 at La Jolla Village Drive, there was the only buildings being built there, the first condo and townhomes there. My brother had the contract for like 300 of them, and we were there, and I was able to drive his truck. He had a big old Power Wagon, and I couldn't even see over the dash. I had to put something under my seat. And I hit a wall with that thing one day, and then they're laughing about it because it was my brother's truck. And then they had this beer, and they bring these cases of beer to the job at 3:30, and it was you know, and they'd give me one or so or two, and then they'd laugh at me, and you know, they'd laugh at me and see how I was drunk and falling all over myself, you know, and then they'd leave me. They'd go to the bars where, you know, the strip bars. There was one here on Jackson Drive, I remember, and they'd leave me in the truck with a six-pack to watch the tools, you know, so while they went in the strip bar. So when they come out, here's the kid again at 12 years old. He's hanging out the door of the truck with a door of the throw-up all over us, you know, and I've only had four or five Coors beers, you know. So, you know, I mean, this is, you know what? The next morning, I was up at 4:30 in the morning, and I was on the job, and I was humping lumber, and I was carrying 10 studs at 12 years old, and I was carrying 50-pound boxes of nails, and I was with the men, and I was doing it, and I was there. I was there. I was a man. I was what my brothers were. I was a 12-year-old, 80-pound, wet, soaking wet man. But I had beer. I had beer. I'd been to the bar. I found it. You know, and you know, after that summer got done, after that summer was done, my brother, at the end of the summer, I had to go back to school, so he'd send me back home. And see, I never really got paid money. My brother just kept it till I was, my other brother in the office, he owned the company, and he's going to save it till I had enough to buy this gun. Well, I'd finally gotten enough, and I bought it, but I kept working in the summers. And that first summer I came home from work over there, you know, they gave me some money, you know, they come home, and I come home, and I have a few bucks, but not all I had that I had coming, but thank God. And I went down to that recreation center, San Carlos Recreation Center, right next to my elementary school where I grew up, and that's where all the long hairs used to hang out. They had long hairs, and they had their tattoos, and they might have had an old piece of junk wannabe Harley or something, and they had, you know, and there the couple girls down there was, you know, and showing their, you know, their bodies off and stuff, and it was the cool. I thought it was the cool. Okay, that's my deal. So I went down there and I got them to go. We went fish at the gas station and got beer, and I'd buy a 12-pack, and they thought, okay, come on, you can drink with us. It's your beer, you know. And then they'd smoke some pot, and then this, and then my initiation to pot and all that other stuff, and it went on. Here we go. Dan's off going rocketing to the third dimension, you know, and that's exactly what it is I took off. You know, as soon as I had that money in that pocket, now I had some peers to deal with and that understood me. You know, and that were real friends. They were real friends, you know. You know, they were there and they were watching my back, you know what I mean? I could drink but there was still something missing. There was still something missing, you know. And I know much I drank, and how much I drank. At night when I went home, I still went home alone without that American girl next to me. So one day after Brenda Spencer, I think it was after Brenda Spencer shot all those kids up. That was right across, real close to where I lived. And I remember it. I was over at my friend's house. I was on house arrest I'd been in juvenile hall. I'd been to camp. I'd been to Rancho del Campo three times. I'd been to Barrett. I'd been to a mall, and for drinking related incidents, either resisting arrest, assaulting another officer, drunk in public or something. But everything I've done after I got sober, I realized everything I ever went to jail for had alcohol on the back end of it. Even though I did drugs and sold drugs, this alcohol was on the back end of it. So I went over there and I met this to this friend of mine's house, and I was to smoke some pot or something or drink or whatever. And this little gal walked in his house, and I never seen her before, and her name was Linda. And she walked in, and she was 4 foot something, and she, you know, I'm only 5 foot four, and I ain't grown in 40 years, so you know. I always think I'm 6 foot two when I drink, but That guy's 6'2", and I'm lighter complexion, and I'm dark and handsome, you know. Ask my wife. thank you, my wife. That's my wife who puts up with me also, too. I'm sorry. My beautiful wife, Tammy, who's never, ever seen me take a drink in my life. Thank God. But yeah, so this little gal walks in, and boy, I mean, she is just cute as a button. She's just like blue eyes, these little tiny freckles around her eyes, and blonde sandy hair from the beach because it's summer, and she's got the summer shorts and clothes on, and she's tiny as a, and I'm just going, oh my God, that's, I'm in love. My tongue was probably under my feet by that time, you know, dragging. And she, we smoked and we did whatever, and Todd left. Who's that? Oh, that's so and so. Oh my God, I was like a puppy dog for 6 months. And 6 months it took, or whatever it was. And finally, I got so frustrated, I knew I was going to be hurt again. And I said, forget it. And I left her alone. You know what? She came right back. She goes, and that's when she came back to me. But I was done. I was done trying to do this. So now there I was. I had the girl. I had the money. I had the friends, you know, the so-called friends. I had the job when I wanted it. I was on top of the world. Who was going to tell? I knew how to do everything. I even had an apartment already, apartment with somebody that was selling some stuff, and he let me and her move in. Then we got pregnant. And I was man enough to do that. I mean, come on. I'm man enough to do that. I'm man enough to, you know, drink my beer. I'm man enough to go to the strip club. I'm man enough to, you know, get the right woman and, you know, do all that stuff. Here I am, you know. And that's how my life went, you know. And I partied, and I didn't hurt anybody at all. Nobody. I never hurt anybody. Nobody. Nobody ever got hurt when I partied, you know. You know, my parents and my family were still there back there, and every time I'd have to come in or get a few dollars till payday, my dad would find it in his wallet and shake his head and then this and that. But I didn't really hurt anybody, you know. You know, I didn't hurt anybody at all. And then what happened one day, we're going to go forward here a little bit, is you understand what's going on there, is I just kept going in and out of institutions, and I had a lot of vehicles. I hit a tree on a motorcycle after a party at the falls out in Ramona. I left early in the morning to go to work, and I hit it head on, and I don't remember, and I bought the helmet I was wearing the night that I went on that trip. And another thing, God working in my life. And anyways, I wrecked my Blazer. I flipped three different times upside down at three different accidents, and then El Camino once. And anyways, a numerous, 60 UIs later, at age of 25, you know, my girlfriend in Escondido, we'd moved to Escondido, and my girlfriend had left, and everybody was sort of pushing away back from me, and I didn't know it. But even though I had the best stuff or this, and I still had my job, and they were pushing back from me, because I was going down hard. And my brother got me another car from one of his employees who was selling it, and I wrapped that around a telephone. No, I took that and moved back to my parents and rear-ended three of my neighbor's cars that I grew up with. They knew me since I was 3 years old, you know. And they all came out of their house, and they just said, oh, Danny, what have you done now? But I hadn't been hurting anybody yet with my drinking. You know, my drinking was my drinking, and my using was my using, you know. So I ended up going, I have a cousin that was an attorney. He's retired now, his daughter's a judge, actually, in El Cajon now. But he's very high up there, so he was able to pull some strings for me a couple different times. And they got me 6 months in work furlough. I'd done a work furlough before. I'd done the one on 32nd Street years before, I'd done another one, a private one, and I was on another private one on University Avenue. It was next door to a machinist place. This isn't my beer bong. So I'd done this. So I went to this place, and I had no problem, you know, going there, because I'd never planned on getting sober out of any time I went to a jail or institution. And it was mandatory that I it was mandatory that I go to AA meetings that were brought in there, and that was fine, and I sort of went and, you know, him hawed. And then what happened was I had a 6 month term there, and then what happened was 6 months into my term, I, you know, like all good alcoholics that are, you know, trying to, you know, figure out something. I had, you know, the Bible I was reading, I was praying and stuff, and 6 months, and, you know, and you, I had my bunk, and I had this guy I met in there, and he turned me on to the Bible, so we were reading this and that, and, you know, and what happened was one night I went to sleep, and I woke up, and it's an open room just like this, and it's big double bunk beds, and they're just spaced apart. There's no partitions or nothing, and they're grown men. I'm 25 years old, okay, and we are sleeping, and it's all the lights are out, and the counselor, the coach, or whoever we call him, coach or counselor, has his own little room, and anyways, he's out over there, and I wake up in the middle of the night, and I'm just shaking. And I'm shaking, and I don't know, and I'm just scared, and tears. My face is wet, and I'm sweating, and I couldn't control myself. And what happened was, finally, I was able to calm myself down. I'm on the top bunk, and nobody, the lights were off, and I just stayed there. You know, and obviously, you don't cry in jail. You know, you don't cry in jail. You know, and here I am. I'm just weeping, like, you know. And I'm not verbally making noise, but I can't control it. So what happened was I laid there, and after a few minutes went by, I know now to this day, it was my higher power, which I call God, passing my life before my eyes of what has gone on in fast motion and telling me that you're done. This is it. Do something. And make it happen. You know, this is it. There's no more chances, no more second chances. And I don't know how I finally fell asleep, but I only had 2 weeks to get out of that place. I was getting out 2 weeks. I got up the next morning, went over to the counselor's office as soon as I could get to him to see him after breakfast, and I told him, I don't want to get out of here. I can't get out of here. I can't. I don't want to be released. Because I can't. We got this bed's already taken, and unless you do something or you go back to, we got to get you, kick you out of here, and you're going to have to go through the court system. I can't get out of here. I was that scared. I was very scared, you know, and you never, ever have I ever not wanted to get out of jail, juvenile hall, or camp, or, you know. And so anyways, I got out. I got picked up by my parents, and I went back to my parents' house at 25 years old, and I had that room that I had no bed in it. It had a couch, you know, and that was because you partied in that room at 25 years old at your parents' house. And I had that, and I went in there, and I said, man, this place is a stinky mess. You know, after 6 months, you know, things start smelling nicer, you know, on the outside than your, you know, place where you party at. So I clean it up, and I'm cleaning up, and I'm vacuuming under the cushions, and I see this three quarters of a lit joint. And I go, oh, and I grabbed it, and I threw it out the window of the bedroom because it had no screen on it. And I started vacuuming and cleaning, and then I shut the vacuum off, and I jumped out the window. And I jumped out the window, and I grabbed that. I found it, and I grabbed it, and I ripped the paper open and went like this and crumbled it and then rubbed it in the dirt. That's how scared I still was from that night of that power coming to me in the middle of the night. I was still that scared three weeks later. It was powerful, okay? And that was the first time God has come to me. That's how I got sober. So when I say I think I'm different, I don't know. I haven't heard that story yet, you know, waking me up and telling me you're going to die, you know. I didn't have no plan on staying sober when I got out of there, you know. So I came home. I got out of there. I had a meeting list, and I had to go to meetings. I had a court card that I had when I got to get out for 6 months, I think it was, or maybe a year, I don't know. But I had a schedule, and I was, after that joint thing deal went on, I go, I can't, I, I need to find this meeting. I found this meeting. I put on my jogging shoes, my nice shoes, my sweats, my shorts, and my nice shirt that looked like athletic shirt. And I jogged up, you know, because I'm cool. I don't have a car. Because I'm cool, you know. Because I'm going to jog, yeah. But I'm going to be looking cool because I'm going to jog to that meeting. They're going to know I got it going down, you know what I mean? This guy's fit, you know. You know, because usually after you come out of jail, you're fit anyway, you know, but I'm going to be fit, and they ain't going to know that I'm just out of jail, and I ain't got no car, and ain't no job, and I ain't got no money, and I'm living on my parents' couch. They're going to think, this guy's got it on, you know. And I go to that meeting, and I find the meeting that's up on Baskin-Robbins on 31 Flavors. It used to be there on Jackson Drive and La Mesa Boulevard, and it was a great meeting, and I walk in the door, and who would I see? Kenny. I see Kenny there, and Kenny is Kenny used to buy pot for me when he was a little kid down at the park. Yeah. And who do I see? I see Kenny, and look, Kenny's still here. He's still here too. And then I see another guy that we used to that I used to steal pot from. He was there too. No. So, anyways. So it's a small world. We're there at this meeting, and they're there, and they're, you know, I don't know. Kenny was a few months sober, maybe, and this other guy was 4 or 5 years sober, 4 or 3 years sober, or something. But I'm going, whoa, man! And they're all pretty relatively young, not like you guys out there. I mean, you guys are pretty old. Yeah, no, they all look like this young man right here, like that. You know what I mean? Yeah, they were young that age, and that's what it seemed like. You know what I mean? There was no gray beards, Tom. You know. Ronnie. Yeah, they're all like him, and they were hip and cool. It's like, man, I can do this, you know, I can do this. And anyways, we did this for, this group was into action. It was a Ted Howell-based group. It was a Ted Howell-backed group. Everybody there had an affiliation or sponsor or sponsee or was sponsored somehow or affiliated to Ted Howell. And if most of you know who he is in here, he used to do a lot of service work in here. And love that man. Passed away, but he's always in forever our hearts. But that man, but that's what it was, and that's why that group was into action. That group right there, those guys turned around. Oh, the first day they go, hey, after, you know, I mean, by the end of that meeting, I was like, people are like shaking hands. Oh, hey, how you doing? Oh, I'm so-and-so. You know, you're supposed to do to the newcomer. Oh, you need a ride? Oh, no, I got to jog back. Get my other half mile in. I still wasn't going to put my guard down. You know what I mean? I ain't going to let him in that close yet. You know what I mean? You know, I don't want to let him know how bad I am right now. You know what I mean? So, no, I got a ride. So probably after about the third or fourth time, I let him give me a ride to the meeting and pick me up. You know what I mean? So we went to those meetings, and what we did is they taught me how to pick up chairs. And they taught me how to reorganize that little room. It was only a little room about this big, you know. And they taught the Neighborhood Recovery Center. That was the name of that place. And it was an awesome place. And they taught me how to make coffee. And they taught me how to mop the floor and take out the bathroom and the trash. You know what I mean? And they taught me, you know how they taught me? They taught me by doing it. And they did it, and then I watched them. I was standing there going like that. I guess better help, you know what I mean? So, you know, and by example. They taught me by example, you know what I mean? And it didn't take too long. I'm sure if it took more than 5-10 minutes, they would have probably told me something. But, yeah, you know, because I know I would have, you know, get that damn broom, you newcomer. You know, that's just the way it was, you know. You know, but they didn't. You know, I caught on pretty good, and, you know, and that's how it started. And then they said, hey, we're going tomorrow. That was Tuesday. Is that a Tuesday, Ken? Ken, that was Tuesday. Wednesday, that was Tuesday, huh? Tuesday. Wednesday, we went to Porter Hall, La Mesa. And that was a Porter Hall meeting. And that was another meeting. The same with the group people were in there and a few other people. And Thursday, we went to Magnolia, Santee, Magnolia. And Friday, we went to Easy Does It Speakers Group on Glebe Street, where I stood at the door and shook hands for hundreds of people and cleaned ashtrays, even though I never smoked a cigarette in my life. And I hated that. I cleaned them after the thing. And the reason why I was doing this stuff was because I was told by my sponsor, and I was told by other people's sponsors, are you willing to go to any lengths? Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? You know, whether it be cleaning an ashtray, you know, giving your last dollar to somebody who needs something to, you know, eat rather than, you know, putting it in the poker machine or anything it takes to, you know, I'm just throwing stuff out there, but willing to go to any lengths. Not that you have to do it. You just got to be willing. And so, you know, that's what, you know, when they asked me to do that, I didn't shrug. I wanted this thing bad. I was a part of it. And what happened was, it was a meeting like this, guys. I mean, that meeting was like this, and it got even bigger, a little bigger. And that was the funnest meeting. We got there early on Friday night, and it might sound boring to some of the people here that aren't alcoholics, but you know what? You know, when you get there early and people, you know, I was standing at that door and people every week would remember my name. They'd say, "Hey, Dan." I couldn't remember their name. I was still brain dead, you know, and I couldn't remember their name. And they told my sponsor, "Just keep standing there. You'll start remembering them. And I'd remember one, I'd remember two, and then they'd all, "Hey, Dan, how you doing?" And then I felt a part of, you know, and then after the meeting, I'd be picking up chairs and stacking them, and then a big old brooms. Then you come through with a big old mops, you got four or five wide, and then everybody'd be heading to Coco's, and we'd have to catch up, and they'd save us seats at Coco's, and or whatever. There was another Bees that was over there at university, and we'd go over there and have coffee, and we'd get home at 11 o'clock, and that was the life. And it sounds boring, but it was the life. But that's what it took to build the foundation from November 17th, 1988 to this day. It took every piece of concrete, every piece of mortar, every drop of water that I had to put in and still put in to do it. And I don't know what ingredient or what one of those things I could not have done that I could get away with so I could still stay sober. So I don't want to risk it. It's like that joint. I don't want to risk it. I'm not going to leave it in the dirt. You know? And I don't know what, you know, because what it is, it's that joint. Then it's that. And then it's the beer. And then it's another beer. You know, and that's how my alcoholic mind thinks, and I'll talk myself right into it. You know, so that was how I, a really instrumental time in my sobriety, and you know, along through these times, you know, going through this program, you know, at 3 years sober, exactly the week of my third year, I was taking my third year. Cake, my father passed away of cancer, and that was a hard thing. He passed away, and my sisters, and the only meeting my sisters and mothers had ever been on, it was easy to the speakers meeting, matter of fact, and they came and saw me get a cake, and they sang, came and came that, you know, the family was close, and another thing, one day, somewhere in there, I was sober, 8 years maybe. I was working up in I'm a general contractor. I'm a framer by trade, and I was framing some stuff up in Rancho Bernardo with another friend of ours that's in the program, Ken Jay, and we were working together. And I was driving up 8. I was heading Waring Road, right past Waring Road on 8. And I was getting ready to go north on 15, and I know right on that ramp where it turns to go 15 north, and it's 4:35 in the morning, and I'm drinking my coffee and I have my little truck, and all of a sudden, this feeling comes over me. It starts here, and it starts here, and it's warm, and it's tingly, and it's moving up slowly, and it's pressure, a lot of pressure. And I don't know if you ever felt it, and it's warm, and it's getting here, and I'm pulling over, and at the same time, my eyes are getting watery, and I'm pulling over up to the shoulder, because I'm doing 55, 60 miles an hour, and I get up to the shoulder and get the car stopped, and by the time I do, it's here, and it comes out, and it sort of tightens my shirt, and I start tearing up and sobbing, and I don't know what it's about. Just like that night when I woke up in the thing, and this is, I'm 8, 10 years sober. And I turned around and composed myself in this car, and you know, and composed myself in this car. And what happened was, I got composed and I started driving again. I go, "What was that?" And I got up by Fry's somewhere, and then I thought of my sister. Well, my sister had been on my my ninth step. I'd done the steps with my first sponsor, and I was with my second sponsor, but me and my sister had a spat a year before, and we hadn't talked to each other. Well, we hadn't talked to each other, and what happened was it said, it's time to go. Something said, it's time to go make these amends to your sister. I was stuck on that ninth step because she was the last one I had to do something for, do something on. And I went over to her house and I knocked on the door. She opened the door, but not the screen. I said, Sylvia, I go, I'm sorry for anything I've done and, you know, to hurt your or anything I've done. And I just want to make amends. And she goes, okay. And then she shut the door and I left. And that's all it was. And 2 weeks later, she was diagnosed with leukemia. And she died within 6 months. This was God doing for me what I could not do for myself again. Okay. I'm fast forwarding again because we're running out of time here, and I like my stories because my stories are really my stories are heavy, and my home group here, they know and they've heard them. You know, we've been to Japan, huh, Ronnie? We've been to Japan, huh? Japan. I was over in Japan after the earthquake in Kobe, and I was over there building some houses for them because they were they didn't have enough people to put. They had 187,000 families out of homes, and they don't have that many people to build them, you know. And so they brought in foreigners, and we went over there, and I had a crew over there to build these small homes. They're miniature, little. They live in little homes compared to us. And I was over there, and I was on the end of a tail end of a relationship that was breaking up, but I committed 6 months earlier to go, so I couldn't. So I was leaving. I was leaving the United States with a relationship that was ready. That I knew this woman was going to start using and drinking or something, and she was going to be gone. And so I turned around. I was in shambles. So I turned around. I get on the plane. I do what I'm supposed to do. I get over there, and within the first week, I asked my interpreter, can you tell me where there is a AA meeting? Because they had to have an interpreter to interpret everything. And he goes, what? I go, and he goes, AA meeting. And he goes, huh? And I go, Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, and he goes, shh. Oh, yeah. He goes, shh. They alcoholism is running rampant in that country, and they push it aside because of pride and ego. And they do not show it, and they don't want you to show it. So it turns around as he goes, yeah. So about a week later he comes by and he shows me his paper, and you know, and he goes, here, go to this address, and it's take the subway here. And so I'm in the middle of Japan. I'm Mexican. I'm, you know, where the heck do I go? I mean, where do I go? I don't have a book to, you know, so I look, I go to the subway, and I don't know which train's running east or west or what, but I just look for signs. Look at that sign, that says sign, I guess that's it, I get on the train. The subway, and I've never rode a subway, I'm driving along, and I go, can anybody tell me when to get off on this exit? And everybody sort of just goes, and looks down. Thing in Japan is they don't take in, when they talk to somebody, it's their tradition that they're responsible for your welfare. So if they start talking to you, then they're responsible. So nobody really wants to talk. So this one guy goes, this guy spoke English. He goes, I'll tell you when he came out of somewhere. I heard him. So he tells me. So he says it. So I hit the thing. I get off the subway and I come out of this, and it's tiki lamps and dark flea markets and, you know, food being sold like you see in the movie. You know what I mean? And I'm like, where the heck am I, man? So I knew it was by the wharf. It was at the Longshoreman's building. That's what he told me. So I could smell the ocean. So I walked towards the ocean smell down this dark street, and I'm trusting in God. I'm turning my will and my life and my power over to the care of God. And I'm going to any lengths. There are beer machines on the sidewalks of Japan. If nobody's ever been to Japan, there are beer machines on the sidewalks of Japan. So I am turning my will and my life over to the care of God because I do not want to get so drunk. I am 13,000 miles away from my home group, and I don't have another person of Alcoholics Anonymous with me. So I'm going to any lengths, like I did when I used to go fish for beer out in the liquor store. Like I did when I couldn't find enough drugs and I knew how to scrape some up off the rug. Like I did. You know that. You understand? Yeah, there's a bunch of you know that. So this is what they say when they say going to any lengths. The same thing. And so what happened was I ended up finding this place this building with a light on it down there, and I walk towards it, and I get towards it, and there's this little sign hanged on the door, and on the bottom sign, and it says AA, third floor, 8 o'clock. I go, wow. So I open it up, and it's a room like this, but it's empty, and on one side's an open door, and it's lit. You can see people in there, and I walk up towards it, and it's a bar full of people sitting at a bar. And on this corner back where they're at, there's another door, and it's a light, and it's a lit stairwell. And I walk over there to the stairwell, and I start walking up. I go, first floor, second floor, third floor. I look, there's only two doors. One says... So I open it up, and it's a little room about 12 by 12 with an 8-foot table in it with literature crowded around it in every language of the world. And it's a little table, and nobody's there. So I sat there, and I go, I found it. So I'm traveled across halfway to Japan. I've crossed through tiki lamps and through this and asked people and this and that, and I've done my deal. I've done the footwork. And what happens is these people finally start coming in. This guy from Sweden comes in. Hi, I'm Jan. I'm from Sweden. Oh, welcome, welcome. Let's start our meeting. And then next thing you know, Sean comes in. And Sean, this guy Sean comes in. He's a tall, dark, handsome, look Japanese, American with a suit and tie, you know, nicer tie than I got on, and just business briefcase and everything. And he goes, hi, I'm Sean. I thought he's going to speak Japanese to me. He said, I'm Sean. He spoke perfectly good English. We did the meeting and we got done, and I asked him to give me a walk back to, I didn't know where it was, to put me on the train. He goes, I'll walk you back. And on the way back to the train, Sean goes, Dan, how do you do it? He goes, 8 years I've been trying to do this. He goes, last night I came to this meeting and met Jan, and I shot heroin right there in that chair, and I drank some alcohol before Jan got here. I just can't do it. My wife's ready to leave me, and my daughter, we got one kid, and she's pregnant with another. And I go, Sean, I go, me and you are going to meet at this place every day until I leave. And then turns around, as what happened was, he goes, oh, okay, so we met every day. And I took my big book with me, and we met every day for 6 weeks I was there. And we shared every day. And he kept me from buying a beer out of that beer machine. He kept me from buying a beer out of that beer machine. Okay? Our participation together kept us both sober. He is 12 years sober right now. And he's got 4 meetings. He's started in Hawaii. He's moved back to the mainland. He sponsors over 20 guys, and he's full bore. And one of his children's name's Daniel. And this is what happens when you go to any lengths to stay sober. These are the miracles of God, and these are the miracles that have happened in my life. And I'm sharing them with you. They're precious to me. They're very precious to me. Because this is God working in my life. This is God working through us to people all over the world. Okay? I'm going to end with this. I'm going to run out of time. This is not my beer bong. Probably a good idea. I wish I thought of it. I was diagnosed with cancer 2 weeks after I proposed to my wife 10 years ago. And I've been fighting cancer with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 10 years now. We've been stage 4 cancer for 6 years, you know. And we're doing a good battle right now, and this is what we need. You know, we need to come out and share our strength and hope, you know what I mean? And my tears right now, my tears are of joy, because the love I know that is in this room, my tears of joy are in joy, because I know I don't touch maybe a lot of people, but the people that God has made me touch or put me in contact with were for a reason, and they've stayed sober. And if none of you get anything, but one of you gets something out of this whole meeting, I've done my job, you know. And the last thing I want to say is that, and it's not everything. Everything I said up here is obviously, you know, I've heard from somewhere else. And my favorite thing is, I should have said in the beginning, is, you know, everything I learned to stay sober was taught to me in the first 30 days of sobriety. There's nothing new that I've learned in the last 24 and a half years I haven't learned anything new. There's no big secrets out there. It's just what we talked about. Giving of ourselves, helping others, and reaching out our hand of AA when it's needed, whether it's 13,000 miles away, you know. And Ronnie, I talked to Ronnie, we've been to Japan, because I was in Japan, and he's the only guy I could get a hold of and talk to when I was losing my butt before I got to meetings. And you know what? He would answer the phone in the middle of the night, even though he had to go to work in the morning, and listen to me, just to listen to me and to help me keep sober. You know, forever, you know, I will always thank you, you know, for picking up the phone when needed be. Everything here has been said by somebody else before me, and there's a little story about, and I'm sure you guys have heard it, maybe it's heard it some other ways, but I love this story, is that the little boy Tommy comes home from school, and he's just rambunctious, and his father's home early, and his father got off early, and his father's sitting there on the couch with his shoes off, and got the paper out, and he's reading the papers. Wife's not home yet, the kid's there, and Tommy's just full of vigor and energy, and he's jumping up and down, and he's, Dad, let's go play the ball, and he goes, oh, just in a few minutes, Tommy, in a few minutes we'll play the ball. And Tommy goes, okay, Dad, it's a few minutes now, let's play the ball, and he goes, oh, no, okay, Tommy, okay, so he pulls the back of the paper, his newspaper, and he pulls it off, and it's a picture of a man, a big full-page picture of a man, article, an ad. And he rips it all up into pieces, you know, like a jigsaw puzzle, and he throws them on the carpet. And he goes, Tommy, put that picture back together, and when you get that back together, we'll go out and play. And he goes back to reading. He goes, okay, Dad. And so he goes back to reading. And 2 minutes later, Tommy's tugging at his leg. He goes, Dad. He goes, I did it. His dad can't believe it. You know, in 2 minutes, he goes, how the heck did you do that? He goes, it was easy, Dad. He goes, when I put the man back together, the world came right back together, too. Thank you.